Hello, friends. This is the Environment Show, and welcome.
You should incorporate environmental education into the plans of all subject areas, but with the greatest emphasis in art and health and science and social studies.
Restructuring national energy policy to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels and bringing down the defense budget to a more realistic number over time are really the top two things that we work on right now.
David Engelson with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. Wisconsin is the only state in the nation requiring environmental education programs K through 12. And Howard Riss, executive director of the Union of Concerned Scientists, outlining that group's objectives in our Environmental Action Group profile this time. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC and is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. This is Bruce Robertson. At the end of May this spring, the U.S. House of Representatives passed its version of the Clean Air Bill Reauthorization Act of 1990. The vote was 401 to 21. This text was sent into joint committee with the U.S. Senate to be matched and reconciled with the version that body had adopted in early April on a vote of 89 to 11. The joint committee has been working but oh so slowly, with various proposed deadlines coming and going. Throughout the proceedings, we monitored the progress, as seen by Chris Ballantyne. Chris is Northeast Regional Director of the Sierra Club, and he joins us now for a midsummer look at what has been developing on Capitol Hill with respect to the Clean Air Bill.
Well, the so-called conference committee, which would resolve the differences in the House and the Senate passed Clean Air Bills, is just finally getting underway. Their first meeting was in mid-July, and they have an enormous task in front of them. Their goal is to reconcile the major differences in the bills through a number of methods, including taking pieces of the House bill, pieces of the Senate bill, and alternatives altogether, and then coming up with a comprehensive conference report that would then be sent back to the individual House and Senate for action.
Chris, I'm wondering if you could recap a little bit some of the major differences between the House of Representatives and the Senate.
Well, as you know, the bill addresses nine major areas: smog, including stationary and mobile sources, alternative fuels, acid rain, toxic air pollution, visibility issues, incineration, CFCs or chlorofluorocarbons, and permitting and enforcement titles. Of those nine areas, we expect that there will be major battles, I think, in the mobile source provisions. At what point do we reduce pollutants at the tailpipe level, and is there a second round? And this has always been something that we've fought for. In acid rain, the question will be when the timetable for the actual reductions is put in place and whether or not so-called bonus credits will be allowed to certain utilities, because the acid rain title is based on a market-based approach. Those are just two of what will be many contentious areas.
Let me ask, Chris, between the two versions, is there one that you prefer over the other, or do you see the whole purpose of a joint committee coming up with the best possible between the two?
Well, we would hope that the conference committee would come up with the best possible bill. I should tell you, by way of background, that the Senate has appointed nine conferees, and in the House there are over 100 conferees. Enough to staff 11 softball teams. Basically, what this means is that a number of members of the House of Representatives are in just for specific provisions related to their committee areas of interest. We hope that the conferees will get together and take the best possible titles of the bills. That's not likely to happen, though, this being politics.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, what we see is a House bill that is generally better than the Senate, except in the area of transportation control measures, which would reduce vehicle traffic in the Senate bill. So we're hoping that the bulk of the House bill gets enacted and certain provisions of the Senate bill would also be included.
Now that Earth Day and April and Earth Day 1990 is well behind us, a time during which there was a lot of fervor, excitement, and participation both in the general public and by politicians, both federal and state level, now that that's quite well behind us, do you sense any kind of falling off of that energy and fervor and interest in Washington and in the general public?
I think that there has been some falling off in the general public's commitment, at least flashy commitment to environmental issues. Public opinion polls continue to underscore the fact that broad base of American population is very concerned about these issues. But when you have an issue that is literally dragged for 10 years, it's tough to maintain any momentum.
It's hard to speculate, I realize, but whatever kind of bill we have in the end, what do you suppose it will be the effect on the average taxpayer citizen?
Well, we actually think that it would be a net benefit, that in point of fact, the costs of dirty air, which are substantial, far outweigh the costs of cleaning up the emissions. What we expect is that in perhaps buying a new vehicle in the course of the next 5 to 10 years, consumers might be faced with an additional $100 for better pollution control technology that will vastly improve air quality both within the region and across the country.
Yeah, and also other health care costs and the like probably you're looking at too?
Very much so, yeah. For people in the Northeast, we expect that the acid rain control program will, over the next few years to a decade perhaps, result in much improved air quality. Will restore or at least delay any further acidification of high-altitude lakes and things along those lines.
Okay, Chris, it's been good talking with you. As we mentioned some time ago on the program, we would be checking in with you from time to time to note the progress, if any, on the Clean Air Reauthorization of 1990. Chris Ballantyne, Northeast Regional Director of the Sierra Club. Good to talk to you, and we'll talk to you again, Chris.
Thank you, Bruce.
There is no telling when the Joint Committee might complete its work. There is speculation that it might be timed just prior to the fall elections, or maybe never. We should note that Congress failed to reauthorize the bill once before in 1976. Time ran out, and with the start of the 1977 session, work had to begin all over again. We'll see. For the Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. With the celebration of Earth Day 1990, awareness of environmental issues increased substantially. One of the recurring messages of Earth Day is the importance of education about environmental matters. The most important place for this education to begin is with our children. Wisconsin is unique in that it is one of the very few states in the nation that require environmental education in the public schools. And as Dave Foch reports, one Milwaukee high school has a unique approach to environmental education.
The idea behind teaching about the environment in public schools began to take shape with the rise of the environmental movement 20 years ago. But in Wisconsin, it wasn't until 1983 that the Department of Public Instruction began requiring all teachers to have competency in environmental education. All Wisconsin teachers now enter the classroom with at least 4 credit hours of environmental education instruction. In 1985, the state of Wisconsin created new curriculum planning standards and, for the first time, required a broad-based environmental education program for grades K through 12. David Engelson is environmental education consultant with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction.
When you're developing the environmental education plan, you should incorporate environmental education into the plans of all subject areas, but with the greatest emphasis in art and health and science and social studies.
By this fall, all public schools in Wisconsin will have an environmental education curriculum in place for all students. No other state even comes close to this level of required instruction. Pennsylvania requires high school students to have 30 hours of environmental education before graduating. Most still consider environmental education to be the realm of science. But the intent of the Wisconsin plan is to spread the focus over many areas of study. David Engelson of the Department of Public Instruction.
But we also think that kids ought to develop citizen action skills, and that the major role or responsibility for that is the social studies. And then we also believe that kids ought to have some kind of citizen action experience. That is, they should not only learn the elements of being a citizen, but they should have some, call it, if you will, behind-the-wheel experience.
Nowhere is hands-on experience coupled with classroom instruction more successfully than at Vincent High School on Milwaukee's northwest side. Here, students are developing a landscape plan for a property nearby. This is one aspect of the agribusiness and natural resources career specialty program at Vincent High School. The 11-year-old program is now a model for other schools, according to program implementer Don Shibesta.
They have come to view our program to see what it is that we do and how we take what is basically an agribusiness program, which usually and apply it to an urban situation. As you've probably noticed going around, we do not deal too much with any means of production agriculture. It's normally what happens after that.
Therefore, there are classes in marketing and floral design built around a floral shop, operated at the school and supervised by teacher Jean Fleischer.
We order flowers from the wholesalers and we arrange them and we sell them to students and faculty members, and we provide other schools with arrangements for their special events and activities.
And are they able to get those at a discount price compared to a regular floral shop?
Yes. Yes. We don't have the overhead that a regular floral shop has, so we're able to provide them at a discounted price, you would say.
But there are also classes in more traditional environmental topics, like fish and game management. Instructor for these classes is Milt Willey, who uses an unusual method of teaching students how to identify birds. He gives them black and white pictures of the birds, an Audubon field guide, and asks them to color the birds correctly.
It may seem very immature, but it's amazing the results that one gets from students that have an interest in what they're doing. As simple as it is, they do have an interest. And I would recommend it to anyone, regardless what age level it is. You simply get a little harder on the species that you make them identify.
Mr. Willey also teaches a gun safety course, unusual for an urban school, but instruction he feels is of growing importance, as kids may have to confront firearms on the streets. Across the hall, George Fuente is teaching a water sciences course.
We've hit, all year long, we've hit big major topics. We've had acid rain, we've had water pollution, we've had groundwater, we've had work on the Milwaukee River. What I try to do is try to pick topics that interest the kids.
The end result is a career specialty program that combines classroom work with field experience, not just during the school year, but year-round on the campus of the school.
This is what you're looking at here. We've got a small deciduous nursery over there. Some of the plants that are started in the greenhouse are propagations that will be going out there in a couple of weeks. That's an acre and a half prairie restoration project. And in about 2 weeks, it starts turning into bloom and then it goes all summer.
Don Shibesta says there are plans to expand program offerings to include an English course focusing on environmental writers and a geography course that puts a global face on environmental issues. Milwaukee's Vincent High School is an extraordinary example of an environmentally oriented education. Only about 200 students are involved in this program, but it is a step in the right direction. Some of these students will go on to become the resource managers, environmental engineers, and agribusiness executives of tomorrow. For the Environment Show, I'm Dave Foch in Milwaukee.
On our journey out and about in the environment, we have often heard an old proverb, variously ascribed to Native American or African sources, that reads, "Treat the earth well. It was not given to you by your parents. It was loaned to you by your children." From Los Angeles, Joy Newell reports on a very special group of children with a special sense about what loaning the earth really means.
Children classified as developmentally disabled attend the Aris Center in Los Angeles. Aris founder Barbara Cull says most of us have some learning disability or another, but those she and her staff deal with are those that public and even most private schools won't take. I visited because Cull told me many of the students are real environmental activists. Right inside the front door are Heal the Bay posters made by the kids. Heal the Bay is a grassroots group active on behalf of the Santa Monica Bay. And Stephanie, curious about my tape recorder and microphone, walked up and told me she recycles.
I recycle to make the earth better.
What's that line for?
So we won't have near 2000, so we won't have the air full of smog and yucky stuff.
As we walked down the hall, Barbara Cull told me about an art project some of the younger children had done about the Huntington Beach oil spill a few months ago.
If you notice the Save Our Earth, there was another mural that they did that somebody took, and it was a sign it was a picture of the earth and a picture of the ocean, and what it said on it was, please don't ruin our ocean, and it had a big oil spill, you know, polluting the beaches and so on, because we want an earth to live on too. They were very, very, very upset when they heard what was happening to the fish and to the birds and to all of the sea life. And they wanted to do something that would let people know how they felt. If you notice, children's natural tendency is to be very much involved in things that sometimes we forget to look at. We forget to look at the flowers and the trees and the grass and the birds and the insects. And children still are aware of those things and still look at them. And if we can teach them now how to think about those things for the future, I think we'll have a much better chance of saving our planet.
Then we walked into the room where we found the poster that Cull had been describing. She told me the children wanted to take the poster down at one point because people with an oil company were touring the school.
And I do think that this is a great picture of what it means to children. If you notice, they did this themselves. They have the, it's almost like the oil is deadly. It's almost like the sun is not smiling.
The sun has a frown on its face.
That's right. And the children clearly were very concerned. Some of the fish have been turned black, and they're very concerned about what's happening to them and the fact that they're not going to be with us.
It's interesting that the children wanted to take the painting down. They were thinking that they would make someone angry.
That's right. And they didn't want to upset them. And I said, no, you need your picture up. You let them know how you feel about it. It's important that they understand how you feel and how important it is to you that the earth be saved.
My daughter was with me that day, and she read another poster we found at Aris Center.
The crew was chopping the tree down. The tree said, help me. They are chopping me down. They are using chainsaws. They are going to turn me into paper and cardboard. Please stop chopping me down. Recycling instead. The crew said, okay, and stopped chopping the tree.
After our tour, we watched a video that Eros uses to tell the center's story. Quite coincidentally, 20-year-old Stephanie, who had told me about recycling earlier, appeared on the tape, singing with Debbie Boone, who had visited Eros. You'll hear Stephanie break up with nervousness on the tape, and since you can't see her, I'll tell you, Stephanie is a person who looks different. For one thing, she wears an eye patch. For me, she speaks volumes about anyone who has ever felt uncomfortable, feeling different or out of place or unusual or shy or brave.
Debbie's visit was a joy and inspiration for everyone involved, but it had special meaning for Stephanie, who received a once-in-a-lifetime chance to sing her heart out to someone who's profoundly touched her life.
So many dreams I kept deep inside me, alone in the dark, and now you've come along. You light up my life, you give me hope to carry on. You light up my days and fill my night.
Professionally, as a reporter, I try to never put words in anyone else's mouth, but I'm going to make an exception. Because in covering the environment, I've met a lot of concerned young people. And what I hear them say repeatedly, in their own words, are, please, let's take care of this planet. We've got to live here. For The Environment Show, I'm Joy Newell in Los Angeles.
Joy Newell reports for The Environment Show from KCRW in Santa Monica. More controversy in New York State over a state plan to poison fish. Recently, the Environment Show reported that the state's Department of Environmental Conservation plans to restore trout populations in several Adirondack lakes by first poisoning the entire fish population. Environmental groups oppose the plan, saying it is both hazardous and against the state's own guidelines. But as Dan Brody reports, a regional chapter of Trout Unlimited heard our story, objected to it, and offered another view.
The New York State Council for the national organization Trout Unlimited has been lobbying in support of the Department of Environmental Conservation's plan to reclaim six ponds in the St. Regis canoe area of the Adirondack Park. In each of these ponds, populations of indigenous brook trout have gone below self-sustaining status as a result of overfishing, as well as from increased competition from non-indigenous species. The plan is to poison all the fish in the ponds and then restock them with the wild heritage strain of brook trout. Jerry Barnhart, Director of Fish and Wildlife Services for the Department of Environmental Conservation, describes how the reclamation process will work, using the poison commonly known as rotenone.
It is applied by pump and by hand-operated backpack pump to the waters of the ponds. It causes the death of fishes in the pond by acting on their gills and inhibiting oxygen exchange across the gills. Our aim is to eliminate all fish in the ponds, and that usually occurs within 1 or 2 days after treatment. The pesticide then detoxifies rapidly, usually within 2 to 4 weeks, and we would go back in 1991 and restock with the wild little tupper strain of brook trout to try and restore the brook trout population to self-sustaining status.
Some have argued that the plan is simply a way to raise more trout. Dave Langan, spokesperson for Trout Unlimited, sees it quite differently. He says that it is man who caused the trout to now exist in such sparse amounts, and is now man who must correct the problem.
Due to the brook trout's vulnerability in its reproductive cycle, it is unable to effectively compete with these fish, and they quickly overwhelm it. Then this has been followed more recently by the ravages of acid rain, which has acidified many of our ponds and lakes. So what has occurred with the brook trout is 200 years of massive ecosystem disruptions, which are man-induced, which has just literally decimated our wild Adirondack heritage strain brook trout population.
Now the question is what to do about it. And your proposal is that reclamation is a positive thing and something that needs to be done, right?
Absolutely. To preserve our remaining heritage Adirondack brook trout strains, we must provide proper habitat. Proper habitat in terms of structure, proper spawning habitat, and also in terms of species. In terms of species, we must provide a community of fish which is representative of the original Adirondack setting, not of the man-induced setting that we have today. We must remove these competitive fishes which man introduced because the brook trout is unable to effectively compete with it.
While environmental hazards have been a major focus of the debate, there is a second argument which says that such practices go against state guidelines as stated by the State Land Master Plan. In response to such claims, Langan argues that protecting the indigenous trout is exactly what the guidelines are all about.
If you consider Guideline 1, it says that we wish to perpetuate natural communities. Well, we ask, can wilderness or canoe waters, whose once predominant brook trout populations, which have been radically depleted by human activity and replaced by common fishes, again by human activity, be considered natural? We don't believe so. To simply protect the degraded state without correcting past environmental damage is to cast aside a precious aspect of our wilderness heritage, namely these heritage-strained brook trout.
On July 27th, the DEC's reclamation proposal was approved by the Adirondack Park Agency, paving the way for the process to begin. So the fate of the fish in this area has already been determined. For the Environment Show, this is Dan Brody.
Founded 21 years ago now, the Union of Concerned Scientists began on the campus of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology as a way of focusing national attention on the scientific issues involved in the anti-ballistic missile system, or the proposal by the Nixon administration to site missile silos around the country. UCS Executive Director Howard Riss says the group later expanded to include issues such as the use of nuclear power and our understanding and use of natural resources, and more recently, the critical environmental issues such as global warming and ozone destruction, topics, in fact, that head up the UCS top 10 list now.
Say global warming is up there probably number one at present, but really is symbolic of a host of environmental issues like acid rain, smog, ozone depletion, and so on, all of which really point to the need for the country to develop a new national energy policy, which would result in much lesser use of fossil fuels, a much lesser dependence on fossil fuels than we are now. So I sort of lump all those together into one category, which is really oriented towards reducing the use of fossil fuels, namely coal and oil, in this country as sort of a major issue for us. I think a second track deals with defense and arms control. The stealth or B-2 bomber right now is the primary focus of our lobbying and legislative work. Overall, we'd like to see the defense budget cut by 50% over the next decade, which would provide a great deal of funds not only to reduce the deficit, but also make money available for solving a host of environmental problems and other domestic needs. So I think those two broad issues are restructuring national energy policy to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels and bringing down the defense budget to a more realistic number over time are really the top two things that we work on right now.
I wonder what your prognosis for the future might be on any one of these critical issues. Are we degrading? Are we holding stable? Or are we actually improving?
Well, I wear two hats on that one. On the one hand, I get rather pessimistic because it's unfortunate, but most people in this country respond only to crises. It was only when the summer of 1988 was very hot that global warming really became a vogue. In vogue as an issue. And then we had a cool summer last year, at least in most parts of the country, and it sort of died off as a front burner issue. And what I fear is that it's going to take several years of hot summers before people will really begin to respond. The flip side of that is I look at our work on arms control and I say to myself 5 years ago, I never would have thought we would have gotten to where we are today. And if you look at the substantial progress, I think a lot of which is due to the rise of Mr. Gorbachev, but really results from substantial public pressure both in the Soviet Union and in this country to begin to move away from the threat of nuclear war, makes me optimistic that we can begin to tackle the larger environmental problems in the same kind of way.
Rees says that news reports, to the contrary, there is not as much disagreement amongst the scientific community over the existence and proportions of global warming. Executive Director Howard Rees, based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Director of the Union of Concerned Scientists, with our environmental group portrait this time on The Environment Show. I'm Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our show for this week. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. If you'd like to join us and drop us a line and let us know about something that is going on that you think we ought to know about, our address is The Environment Show, WAMC, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.